you know as soon as we got everything up and rolling. And Mr. Chair, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Good morning and welcome to the meeting of the Santa Ana Regional Water Quality Control Board for December 4th, 2020. I will begin by asking our directors to introduce themselves. And this morning we are joined with our very newest director, Ms. Letitia Clark. And Letitia, would you kind of give us a little bit about yourself so we know and some of those folks who are on the Zoom or calling in know a little bit about you. Welcome.
Yes, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to join you all. I'm excited to serve on this board. My name is Letitia Clark. I reside in Tustin, California in Orange County, California. And my day job, I'm the District Director of Public Affairs and Government Relations for the South Orange County Community College District. And I also serve on the Tustin City Council. And as of Tuesday, I was appointed mayor by my colleagues. So I now serve as the mayor.
Congratulations.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So I'm excited to delve in deeper in this subject. I've never served on a water board before, but I'm very interested in the topic. And I hope to be able to be a valuable contributor. So thank you all for the warm welcome.
Thank you. Director Kerr.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. And welcome to Mayor Clark. We're so glad to have you on board. I'm Joe Kerr, retired firefighter, and I'm very, very happy to be here. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Director Murray.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, and colleagues and staff and everyone who's listening from the public.
So, this one has problems.
I'm sorry?
Yes.
Is it working?
Yes, ma'am. Hello? Everything's working.
Okay.
Thank you.
My name's Chris Murray. I want to welcome our newest member, Mayor Clark. Congratulations on both your reelection and your appointment as mayor. Well-deserved. Look forward to serving with you. Just take a moment this morning. I'm a former council member in Anaheim, a little bit about me, as well as a very proud mom. But I just want to say my thoughts and prayers are with our firefighters again who are dealing with blazes in Southern California and the bonfire. It's not far from here, not impacting us directly yet, but impacting many, many residents. And so our thoughts and prayers are with all of you.
Absolutely. Next, Director Peterson.
Hi, everyone. Lana Peterson. I live in the city of Orange, actually. So it's good to see everyone virtually. I hope someday we will all see each other in person. Welcome to Mayor Clark. Nice to have you on board. And have a good holiday, everyone, if I don't see you. I'm very excited for December. I'm very excited for the year to be over. I wish I could say this. I'm very excited about, like, hopefully the pandemic will be over soon, too, so I can get back to normal. So anyway, nice to see you guys.
Let's see. Director Selmy.
Good morning. I'm Dan Selmy. I'm a professor of law at Loyola Marymount University. I live in Newport Beach. Welcome to Mayor Clark. Nice to have you with us. And just a reminder for everybody that the rules on masks are serious. My son just got through having a bout with COVID, and I can tell you it's a scary business. So everybody be careful out there.
Good.
Dr. Rivera.
Good morning, everybody. And my name is Tom Rivera, and I live in Colton, California, which is in the Inland Empire. And I want to wish everybody a happy holiday and welcome our new mayor to our committee.
Thank you, Dr. Rivera. And I am Bill Rue. I am at present the chair of the Santa Ana Regional Water Quality Control Board. In my life away from here, I am a council member of the city of Montclair, California, where I have served on the city council since 1998. In my professional life, I do governmental affairs and public policy for the Citrus Valley Association of Realtors, and I am the proud father of a pug and a Pomeranian. And welcome, Mayor Clark. We look forward to having you with us. That brings us to our public forum. This is the time and place set aside for any person to address the regional board on any matter within the regional board's jurisdiction, provided that the matter does not appear elsewhere on this agenda or has not been scheduled to appear. Yes.
No, I just coughed. I'm sorry. Oh, okay.
On a future agenda and is not otherwise pending before the board. It looks as if under the public comments submitted, and we under the rules right now, we take public comment in advance simply because it's the only way to accommodate this under the Zoom and everything else. I don't know if he's on. We have Scott Maloney, who would like to speak. And I know, Mr. Maloney, that you know you cannot address any of the details on Poseidon. Is Mr. Maloney on?
Chair Rue, yes, he is.
Okay.
We're showing him as an attendee.
Okay. Welcome, Mr. Maloney.
Good morning, Chair Rue. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can, sir.
Good. Thank you. I fully appreciate the board's policy of not addressing items pending before the board, so I will not address the substance of the Huntington Beach project, but with your permission, I would like to address your 2021 meeting calendar as it relates to the project.
Okay, that's fine. It's later on here, but that's okay. Well, we can do that.
Yeah, that's agenda item number 5. Right. So for the board's benefit, my name is Scott Maloney. I'm the vice president of Poseidon Water. Before the board votes to adopt your 2021 meeting calendar today, I'm asking that you consider adding a second meeting to your schedule in the second half of February to accommodate our request for the timely consideration of the adoption of the renewal of the Huntington Beach Desalination Project's permit. The board is not meeting in January, as you know, and the February meeting is scheduled early in the month on the 5th. To date, we have provided your staff with all the information they have requested to amend the desalination project's permit for the board's guidance this past August. Your staff is working very hard.
Mr. Chair, I'm afraid that Mr. Maloney is getting into project specifics and project.
Okay.
Yeah, I agree. So, yeah,
all right. We just need to look at the consideration of another date in February. Is that the request, Mr. Maloney?
Yeah, just to close it out, we respectfully ask that the board provide Poseidon and your staff with a February hearing deadline. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, sir. And I think, staff, we can work on seeing what we can accommodate under the guidelines set forth by the governor and the fact that we are now all in virtual meetings. So yes. Ms. Mike and others will be able to work on that.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. That was the only speaker we had under public comment. That brings us to item number 3, State Water Resources Control Board Liaison Report, Mr. Sean McGuire. And I know Sean is on our call. Welcome.
Good morning, everyone. Good member, morning, Chair Rue and members of the board. And welcome to Board Member Clark. Good to have you on the team here. So my name is Sean McGuire, and I am a State Water Resources Control Board member, one of 5 board members. And as you may know, we have 9 regional water quality control boards. And so one of the assignments we take on as state water board members, and we're actually full-time appointed members. So it's a little bit different at the state water board level. So what we do is we take on a role of being a liaison to the regional boards. And so I've been the liaison, state board liaison to the Santa Ana Regional Board, I think for going on about 2 years now. So it's been a really, I think, good opportunity for me to learn more about the Santa Ana region and your issues and needs as it relates to what we do at the state water board level, and also for me to act as a conduit and a way to help share information and, you know, latest events and things that are happening at the state board level with you. So, you know, this is, for me, a fairly informal presentation. I'm really here to convey information, to answer questions, and I have a couple of items to update you on today, but I just want you all to know that, you know, I'm always open. You know, if there's any issues you want me to cover, we do a lot at the state water board level. And board member Clark in particular, just so you're aware. So, certainly we have a lot of overlapping responsibility at the state water board. We do oversee implementation of the Clean Water Act and Porter Cologne Water Quality Control Act. So all nature of water quality regulation at the state board level. A lot of what we do is we establish statewide permitting, statewide policies, and I'm going to actually talk a little bit about one this morning. So that's why I wanted to tee this up for you. Sean,
let me make a comment, Sean.
Sure.
You mentioned that you've been with us for 2 years now. And Sean, not only have you matured and look matured, but you have grown a wonderful beard that makes you more mature. So we're delighted to see the growth that you've done over the last couple of years.
Yeah, well, that's because I can't get a haircut or anything, you know, so I have to, it is what it is. Well, thank you. Appreciate that. Believe it or not, I'm actually not even the youngest state water board member, and I won't tell you who is.
Joaquin, I think.
I may look the youngest, but I'm not. So we establish statewide policy for water quality control. We also review sometimes when there's, you know, controversial or different actions that regional water boards take. Those actions can be petitioned by stakeholders up to the state water board level for additional review. So that's a process that we do on a number of different issues. And then we also, some big responsibilities are regulating drinking water, providing safe drinking water for all Californians is a huge priority at the board. We have a division of drinking water. So it's the last few years has, you know, so the division of drinking water and that responsibility has been with the state water board for about 5 years now. And so that's been a very high focus and priority area for us. And then last but not least, well, two other things. So we also allocate water rights. So we have a division of water rights and we're responsible for administering a very complex system of California's water rights. And I'm happy to go over that with you at another time. And then we also have a division of financial assistance. And so we issue grants and loans for water quality improvement projects, for drinking water projects all throughout the state to a number of different water systems and communities in need. So as you can see, just to paint a broad brush, we have a wide breadth of responsibilities. So when I come here today, I can talk to you about any of those and all of those as needed and as you're interested. But today I'm going to talk to you about a few priority items and we can go from there.
So thank you for that.
Yeah. Good to see you. So I'm sure we'll meet in person someday soon. So one is this week we had our state water board meeting and it was a big meeting because we adopted the toxicity provisions. And what those are toxicity is something that obviously I think we can all recognize is something we do not want our water to be toxic. We do not want our discharges from wastewater treatment plants, from industrial facilities, from other types of facilities into our waterways to have toxic constituents in them. And so we do a lot with our permits currently to measure different chemicals you know, in that water where we know what they are, to try and, you know, reduce them. We have effluent limits. We have different controls on them to, you know, keep our water clean and safe. But sometimes there can be constituents in the water that we just can't measure readily. And yet we know that it's harmful to our receiving waters and to our ecosystems. And so all discharge permits have condition in them as it relates to toxicity. But where it gets challenging is how you actually measure it, how you monitor for it, and how you ensure compliance with making sure that, you know, if a wastewater treatment plant facility is discharging, that their water is not toxic. And so different regional boards have tackled this and addressed this through their permits in different ways over the years. And so this is an example of where the state board has moved to establish requirements that are statewide. And so the monitoring, the rules for what facilities need to monitor and when, what compliance is, what a violation is now consistent throughout the state for the most part. And so it was actually a policy that was in development, believe it or not, for 17 years. And it's hard to say. And we've had a lot of policies that just take a long time because they are complicated. There are, you know, it's not easy developing a policy that applies to an entire state, which is such a diverse number of watersheds, a diverse number of communities. It's hard to say, okay, now how are we going to fit these requirements into that? But I think we've done it here. I think we've threaded the needle. We'll see. And so just so you know, you'll probably hear about it here and there as you do your work. But we've adopted what's called the Test for Significant Toxicity, which is the TST, and it's a statistical analysis that analyzes, basically, you look at different bugs and you look at how well they survive when they're in contact with the discharge water, and you analyze that. And it's not all the bugs die or they don't die. There's some analysis that happens there, and I won't get into all that today. But suffice to say, you know, we now have those rules. And so your board will have to take this new statewide policy into consideration when you're updating permits for your dischargers. And so that's, you know, an area where, as an example, where the state board now works with the regional board. So it was a big deal, a long time coming, as you can tell. And so I'm happy to be able to report to you that that's one major policy that we were able to get over the finish line this week. Just a couple of other things. You know, one is that we've all been, you've talked about it already today. You know, we've all been grappling with the impacts of COVID and the pandemic. And I think the fact that we're all here on Zoom together is just an indication of how well adapted we've become, that we were able to transition what for decades has been a very much an in-person interaction with our regional boards, with our state boards. We frankly very rarely used any of this technology before this year, other than some recording and streaming. You know, we've adapted in so many ways to be able to continue our really critical work. I mean, it's come with costs, but it's also opened lots of opportunities. And maybe you've seen this as a city council member and other board members as well, you know, just being able, especially at the state board level here, for us to be able to engage with the public. Really anyone in the state can join our meetings and weigh in on issues that are of interest to them without having to travel. You know, we had an item this year on the Salton Sea, for example, and it was in, you know, we hosted it over Zoom. And so folks who were interested in that issue didn't have to travel from the Salton Sea to Sacramento to tell us about their concerns. So there's a lot of, you know, exciting things going on there, I think, for the future, you know, post-COVID, as we look at how can we, you know, continue to be a very transparent and inclusive organization while embracing technology and kind of everything that we've learned and have had to go through here with the pandemic. Now, that's the good news, I think, maybe the silver lining. Some of the bad news or challenging news is that there have been budget impacts that, we've had, we've had 5% of all of our staff assigned earlier this year as contact tracers, and that's COVID contact tracers, and that's, staff from the regional boards as well as the state board. We have about 2,300 employees statewide, and so so that's obviously incredibly important work. We're very supportive of contact tracing and doing that work, but it does come with a trade-off in terms of that's work that we're not able to now complete at our boards. We also have gone through salary reductions and furloughs. So approximately 10% salary reductions for all staff, which is being compensated by some additional vacation time, or basically furlough time that they're able to use flexibly. Those are actions that took place sort of earlier this year. And so the latest one that I just wanted to mention was that there is a Department of Finance letter issued about a month ago as they're looking at the upcoming budget and the future. And the latest request is for an additional 5% across the board reduction in spending. And so all of the boards, departments, and offices need to come up with a plan to accommodate for that additional 5% reduction. So I know that as board members, we don't generally get into the details of the budgets, but that's up to our executive staff, your executive officer. I think it's important to be cognizant of and aware that, these are additional pressures. You'll probably hear about resource challenges, staffing on various, permitting programs. And I assure you that is not unique to the Santa Ana Regional Board, to any regional board, or even the state board. We're all resource strained. And so these additional challenges that we've come across here with COVID and the budget impacts are real. They do have significant impacts, and just I want you all to know that we're aware of that, and we do, of course, factor that in when we're thinking about what we can accomplish here as a team. So, one other COVID-related item is that we're trying to use technology to our advantage here, and so one effort that has been underway since March really has been a coordinated effort with wastewater treatment plant dischargers to actually monitor and survey the presence of COVID-19 in our discharges, and trying to use that information as an indicator of either increasing caseload or identifying areas within our communities where we're starting to see or maybe seeing occurrences of COVID-19. Even when there's was at least initially a lack of testing. And so it's been promising. I think it's encouraging, especially for the future, either as we see through this pandemic here or maybe for future instances. And so we're, many, many wastewater treatment plant facilities, dischargers are doing this testing around the state and really around the country and the world. And we've learned a lot. There are some partnerships with Stanford and other universities looking at this. And at the state board, we're also working on regulations now for direct potable reuse. So basically being able to take highly treated wastewater for the first time and using it as an augmentation for drinking water in a couple of different ways. And happy to talk to you about that more in the future. But one of the big concerns has been about pathogens. About viruses, about other pathogens that might occur. And how do we know, how can we have confidence that we're able to do and protect human health if those types of things are to occur? And so this was a really unique opportunity that popped up. We've incorporated this COVID-19 investigation as one of our research projects, things that we need to understand better before we complete our regulations, so that we can ensure that, you know, no matter what we come up with here, that we are being fully protective of public health first and foremost, because that is all of our missions here. So just, you know, thought you'd be interested in that. It's, you know, really exciting, I think, information in an area where it just shows, you know, we're adapting and we're embracing technology and things that come at us, I think, in new ways and always open to new ideas. And
Yes.
Ms. Clark?
I was just saying thank you for all the information.
Oh, sure.
Oh, okay.
And I have one more thing. And again, always happy to take questions. And that is in October. So once a year, we have a get together with all the regional boards members and all the state board members. And it's called our WQCC, which is our Water Quality Coordinating Committee. And it's a really, really great opportunity for all of us to meet in person. It's the only time during the year, because normally we have, you know, obviously limitations on notice meetings with our Open Meeting Act. And so this one is a notice meeting. So it's open to the public, but really it's for all of the board members to share, you know, their experiences, to hear from the regional boards about what you've been seeing in your regions, and to share with you updates from the governor's office, from the state board. And so I had a really interesting, unique WQCC this year, because it was all on Zoom. But I thought it was actually a really great discussion on a whole host of issues, from, you know, legislative updates to COVID impacts. There's actually a whole segment on just, you know, some of the COVID issues that I just discussed in greater detail. We had it's a 2-day event, and the second day we had a session on a several hour session and discussion actually on racial equity issues and a lot of the work that we're doing at the boards to better embrace both, you know, inequity that occurs within our organization and also outside our organization, so that we can better serve our communities. So we have a racial equity initiative underway right now. And a lot going on there. We actually had 4 listening sessions this week with members of the public to hear from them about how we at the regional and state water boards can better address those issues going forward. We're working on resolutions that kind of solidify those principles. We have a steering committee, which actually Executive Officer Smythe is on. So greatly appreciate her contributions to that group. And so we've had work going on in this space for, you know, actually a few years now, but it's really accelerated this year with all the various events there, as I'm sure you're aware. So really exciting. So that's an example. I think actually in the 2 WQCCs that I've been a participant on, that was by far, I think, the best discussion that we've had, because we had breakout groups, and it was really an open conversation about those issues. And so, you know, this is really just something I wanted to flag, you know, for all of you board members, that this really is a unique opportunity, whether it's in person or over Zoom. I really hope that in the future you're able to participate, you know, even if it's for half a day, just part of the event. I understand that you have day jobs. You have other things going on, but there really is a lot of value to attending and actually to hearing from you and your perspectives on issues. And so, you know, the good news, though, is that it was all recorded, because we're in this digital age. It's all on YouTube. So if you don't have the link, let me know. I can get that to you, or Executive Officer Smythe can get that to you. And you're welcome to watch, you know, any of those discussions and those updates at your leisure when you have time. So I encourage you to do that. And then hopefully next year, maybe we're all back in person again, and we can get together wherever that is and you know, really see each other and have some good conversation. So that's it for me today. But again, if you have any questions, I'm all ears.
Sean, this is Tom Rivera. Sean, you've perked my curiosity on the Salton Sea. Where can I get more information of what the what has transpired and what an update locally of what's happening in that area.
Sure. We should. So the National Resources Agency is the lead on the Salton Sea Management Program and the restoration efforts there. I'm positive they have a website that has information.
Yeah, if you can send the website, I'll follow up on that.
Happy to do that. And happy to catch up with you on that as well.
Can I ask a question real quickly, Sean? Sure. You talked a little bit about Zoom, the technology, and the advantageous like nature of it. Do you know if the State Water Board is doing anything? You know, there's a big digital divide. I think you guys probably know some people just don't have access to technology, right? So do you know if the State Water Board is addressing anything around kind of public participation in certain communities? You know, Zoom is great, but what if people can't get on in certain communities to do their public comment? So is there alternative ways for them to provide kind of public participation? Have you guys kind of broached that subject?
Yeah, that has definitely come up. And I would say, you know, for us and for me personally, it's an all of the above approach. You know, I think when we're able to go back into the communities and we've done this, we've done workshops, you know, especially, for example, with safe and affordable drinking water in our new funding program there last year. We did workshops all around the state where we went to a number of communities, you know, that we felt were, you know, most impacted by a lack of safe drinking water. And we went to them directly to have discussions there and hear from those folks. Last year, we actually went to the Salton Sea and had our public meeting there. We brought our board to the Salton Sea so we could make sure we heard from those communities there. So I think, you know, going forward, it's going to be a combination of that, as well as continuing to provide this sort of online access. And, you know, I know there's a lot of interest in, you know, providing greater access to broadband services statewide. I mean, obviously, that's a little bit out of the water board's wheelhouse, but certainly something we would support to the extent we can do that. And so, yeah, and then always open ideas if you've got ideas about how we can be better and be more effective at hearing from folks. Sometimes I think, you know, one of our biggest challenges is actually getting the word out and explaining to people what we're actually dealing with. Like, what are the issues that we're talking about and how and why would they be interested in actually participating? And I think, you know, we speak in a lot of really technical lingo, and sometimes it's just, you know, folks may not realize that some of the decisions that we're making, some of the issues we're discussing actually will impact them. And so, you know, for me, that's something that I think we need to continue to work on and improve is our messaging and our outreach.
Yeah. You know, in my professional role, I do community meetings or I participate in community meetings in high need areas. And the biggest challenge is they can't actually even get on Zoom. They call in, right? Because that's the easiest way they can do it. Zoom is a technology barrier for them. So it is worth kind of considering how we continue this model and then also be able to have something for people that can't get on.
Yes.
Definitely. And then a quick question. You know, you talked a little bit about the toxicity provisions throughout the state. So I think everyone on this board, even though I'm 4 years in, I'm still going to say I'm new. I'm new to water. Can you give kind of like an example of like how the local, like how would we in the region work? How does it like kind of transpire on a local level is my question with those provisions. Like, it seems like it's a big deal. I guess I'm just not grasping how we would be involved.
Okay. And Executive Officer Smythe might have a better, more specific example, but basically, if you have a POTW, publicly operated treatment work, with an NPDES permit, and pardon me for using a lot of acronyms, but if their permit, it may have some requirements about preventing toxicity, but it won't have necessarily yet specific effluent limits. So what this new toxicity test does and monitoring requirements is it sets kind of, it's a pass-fail. So basically it's an analysis that says you have a species, an example is a fathead minnow, it's a little fish and you take a sample, and a lab will analyze that sample by putting the fish in a sample of your water, that discharges water, and then monitoring it for a few days to see if they survive or they don't. And basically that goes into a statistical analysis, which then says, all right, this water is toxic, or this water is not toxic. And if it's toxic, that discharger could then be subject to a violation. Or they could be subject to additional steps to figure out exactly what caused that toxicity in the first place. And so one of the big challenges is sometimes you just don't know. It could just be a slug of something that made it into the sewer, that made it through the wastewater treatment plant, and you don't really know what the cause is. But sometimes you can figure out what the cause is and eliminate that. And so in summary, that's kind of what it is. I don't know, Executive Officer Smythe, is that a good way to kind of summarize that?
Yeah, I think you captured it very well, Board Member McGuire. And just so that the board knows, we do implement, we will be implementing those toxicity provisions, as Sean indicated, through all of the permits, wastewater treatment plant permits or other various permits that the board issues. So that's how we implement it. We'll be implementing it.
Right.
Thank you.
Sure. And it'll take place over time, right? So it's, as permits come up for renewal, it'll probably come across your desk for considering, whether to issue that renewal or what have you. And so that'll be an element of it. So.
And I want to thank Director Peterson for bringing up the equity issue as far as technology. There is, in many of our communities, a huge technology gap. I know in my community, we have many residents who still have dial-up. We even have a mobile home park that is on dial-up. And although we are working with them to be able to get the infrastructure handled, it is a problem. And for many of our lower income families, just even being able to afford $60, $80, $100 a month for internet service is a huge barrier. So I think it's something we can all start to look into and work on, because we need to be as inclusive as we can.
Absolutely. Great point. Yeah, thank you for sharing that.
Are there any other questions for Mr. McGuire? Thank you.
Thank you.
Thorough report, Mr. McGuire, and please give our best to everybody on the state board.
Will do. Be safe, everyone.
I would like to now, before we get into the rest of our agenda, turn this over to our CEO, Ms. Smythe, to introduce our wonderful staff who have joined us this morning.
Thank you, Chair Rue. So participating in the meeting today is Assistant Executive Officer Jane Joy, our three division chiefs, and Sturdivant, Mark Smythe, and Lama Willis. We also have a number of senior staff participating today to answer any questions as needed. Of course, Jeannie Aguilar is serving as the clerk of the board this morning, and Don Nguyen, Dan Mefford, and Kevin Heineman are serving as our IT support. And then, of course, Teresita Sablon is providing legal counsel this morning. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Smythe. That brings us to item number 4, our regional board meeting minutes of September 11th, 2020. They have been distributed to everybody in their packet. If you have reviewed them, I would entertain a motion.
So moved.
Moved by
Kerr.
Director Kerr. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Director Murray. All in favor?
Aye. Oh,
wait, roll call vote. I'm sorry. Ms. Aguilar, will you do the roll call vote?
Yes. Board Member Letitia Clark.
She has to abstain. She was not here.
I was going to say that I abstain since I was not.
Board Member Joe Kerr.
Aye.
Board Member Chris Murray.
Aye.
Board Member Lana Peterson.
Aye.
Board Member Daniel Salmi.
Aye.
Board Member Dr. Tom Rivera.
Aye.
Chair William Rue.
Aye. That brings us to item number five, our board meeting dates for 2021. Before we move for adoption, I know our staff, if need be, will perhaps have to add some dates or maybe defer a date due to our workload. The newer board members may not be aware of that, but sometimes we move a date because the workload is such that it demands it. Other times we may add a date. We may have a specific item that takes a lot of attention, so we'll add that. In a review of the dates at present, they are all virtual meetings until we are deemed able to meet in person again, and I do want to see everybody again. With that, does anybody have any conflicts with the dates at present as presented before us? No. As such, then I would ask that a roll call entertain a motion for the board meeting dates for 2021.
So moved.
Moved by Dr. Rivera. Is there a second?
Second.
Second by Director Clark. All in favor? I keep doing that. Ms. Aguilar, could you do a roll call vote?
Board Member Letitia Clark.
Aye.
Board Member Joseph Kerr.
Aye.
Board Member Chris Murray.
My vote is aye, but I just wanted to ask, are we going to add that second meeting in February that was requested? Or are we going to have that discussion?
So I would propose that staff looks at our schedule and the timing to release the tentative order for the Poseidon facility, and then we can work on scheduling it at that time.
Thank you so much.
Board Member Chris Murray?
Aye.
Board Member Lana Peterson?
Aye.
Board Member Daniel Selmy?
Aye.
Board Member Dr. Tom Rivera?
Aye.
Chair William Rue?
Aye. And as we said at the public comment with Mr. Maloney, staff would be working with him to see what we can do to accommodate that. That brings us to item number six, appointment of a committee to nominate regional board officers for 2021. This is an action item. I'd like to see if Director Kerr and Director Murray would like to serve on that committee.
I'm more than happy to.
Thank you,
Director. Likewise. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And they will bring back nominations for board officers at our next meeting. With that, it is an action item. I will need a roll call vote. Ms. Aguilar.
Board Member Letitia Clark.
Aye.
Board Member Joe Kerr.
Aye.
Board Member Chris Murray.
Aye.
Board Member Lana Peterson.
Aye.
Board Member Daniel Selmy.
Aye.
Board Member Dr. Tom Rivera.
Aye.
Chair William Rue.
Aye. That brings us to item number seven, consideration of our consent calendar. There are six items before us, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and 13. Item number 10 did have an errata sheet that was distributed to us. Are there any questions on that, or does any of the board members wish to pull an item? Hearing none, I would then entertain a roll call, a motion for item number seven as presented.
So moved.
Second.
It has been moved by Dr. Rivera, second by Director Murray. We would then ask Ms. Aguilar for a roll call vote.
Board Member Letitia Clark.
Aye.
Board Member Joe Kerr.
Aye.
Board Member Chris Murray.
Aye.
Board Member Lana Peterson.
Aye.
Board Member Daniel Selmy.
Aye.
Board Member Dr. Tom Rivera.
Aye.
Chair William Rue.
Aye. That brings us to item number 14, presentation of the recent groundwater management zone's ambient water quality determinations for the period of 1999 to 2018. And that will be the lead on that will be our CEO, Ms. Smythe.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about this because we have an excellent presentation plan for you to give you all of the background information. But what I just want to emphasize to you is that this particular item and effort is extremely important for our region because it involves our groundwater resources, which are, again, very critical for water supplies in our region. And this item, as well as the next item, are also related to our salt planning efforts within the region as well. These two salt management planning efforts are run through the Basin Monitoring Program Task Force, which is a group of water supply and wastewater agencies that was established back in the late 1990s. Tess Dunham here today will be providing an intro to this item, and then we'll turn over that time to Mike Krushenko, who will be providing the technical presentation. So I'll turn it over to Tess.
Thank you so much, Hope, and hello and good morning to all of the Santa Ana board members. It's such a pleasure to be here and to introduce myself. I'm quite excited about this opportunity. I have recently come into the task force to work as their regulatory facilitator, replacing Tim Moore, who has been an instrumental part of the task force for, 30 years, Mr. Roos? So it's been a long time. So big shoes to fill, but I'm excited. I have worked in water quality issues around California for over 25 years. And I just have to share you that we have admired, and I have admired in the many other regions that I've worked, the work that the task force have done, both in the Basin Monitoring Task Force and the others, over the years. And truly, the task force process that this water board has is a hallmark for all the other regions. We try to replicate it in the Central Valley with our salt nitrate management plan that was a 10-year process. And, you know, the work that the stakeholders and the regional board staff has done is just truly remarkable. And I truly am honored to be a part of this process and to continue the legacy forward that this task force has set over the years. So with that, under the Basin Plan amendments, for those of you that may be newer, the Basin Plan requires that the Basin Monitoring Task Force put forward a recomputation of ambient water quality for the groundwater in the Santa Ana River watershed for a 20-year period, but we put this forward every 3 years. And so what we're going to present here today, and Michael Cruikshank from WSC is going to put forward the most recent recomputation, which is for the period of 1999 through 2018, which was completed and submitted to the Water Board over this last year. So with that, I'd like to introduce Michael, and again, just excited to be working with all of you on the Basin Monitoring Task Force issues, to which we will have some others come before you early next year with respect to some basin plan amendments. And so we will be seeing you again, and hopefully sometime in 2021, I'll have the chance to meet you all personally, other than over Zoom. But thank you for allowing me to be here today. And with that, unless there's any questions for me, I'll turn it over to Michael.
Okay, great. Well, thank you very much, Tess and Hope. Good morning, board members, and really appreciate the opportunity to present the results of this ambient water quality recomputation. My name is Michael Cruikshank, and I'm a hydrogeologist with Water Systems Consulting. And I was the project manager for this effort. And I apologize in advance, I seem to be running an elementary school in my house. So if there's any noises, it's my students, AKA children. next slide, please. So before we really dive into this, and I'm going to try to be brief here, but there's some definition of terms that I think would be helpful when we talk about the ambient water quality. The first is groundwater quality objectives. And these are defined in the Porter-Cologne Act as the limits or levels of water quality constituents or characteristics, which are established for the reasonable protection of beneficial uses of water or the prevention of nuisance within a specific area. And then ambient water quality. So ambient is defined as surrounding environment, but in the context of this study, we're referring to the ambient nitrate and TDS concentrations that are given or that are representative of a given volume of groundwater, which in our case is a water in storage in a groundwater management zone for a given time period, which is 20 years, and it's evaluated every 3 years, as Tess had mentioned. And we'll describe that in a little more detail as we move through the presentation. Next slide, please. So Tess and Hope kind of provided a little bit of background, but this task force was started in 1995 and really formed to study the impacts of salt and nitrate that they have on the long-term sustainability of our groundwater supplies. And the task force administered by SAPA and includes the regional board, which is really important during that initial process. And there they revise the groundwater basin boundaries. They set new water quality objectives based on a better data set. They developed the rigorous scientific method for computing these volume-weighted ambient water quality determinations, which we use today. Next slide, please. So in 2004, the Basin Plan Amendment requires the implementation of this watershed-wide monitoring program, and we determine the ambient water quality in groundwater. We assess compliance with those groundwater quality objectives mentioned below and above, and we determine if assimilative capacity exists in those groundwater management zones. And it's kind of known as, or back before salt nutrient management plans were a thing, this was kind of the initial salt and nutrient management plan. It's kind of seen as a functionally equivalent salt and nutrient management plan over a watershed-wide scale. Next slide. So this is actually the sixth ambient water quality recomputation that the task force has undergone over the last few years. And as I said, this is over this, the calculation is over a 20-year time period. And the reason for that is because changes in regional groundwater, it happens over a longer period of time. They happen pretty slowly when compared to surface water, where it's more immediate. So a 20-year time period accounts for overall changes in regional groundwater quality. Next slide, please. So here's a map of the Santa Ana watershed, and it shows the 37 groundwater management zones in the watershed, and the associated ambient water quality objectives for both TDS and nitrate. And the TDS objectives are seen in the top number and the bottom number are the nitrate objectives. And these, our watershed includes a diverse set of groundwater basins, from very large groundwater basins like in Orange County and Chino Basin, Bunker Hill Basin in the San Bernardino area, to smaller basins like the Arlington and Riverside Basins, where there were shallower and not as much groundwater exists for production. Next slide. So talk quickly about kind of the different phases in actually doing this work. So there's really four phases. There's this data gathering, and we're collecting groundwater quality data from a lot of wells in the watershed, and QA and QC and processing of all that information is an ordeal. It's a lot of work. And from that, we, based on the basin plan and the prescribed methods, we calculate these point statistics for each of those water quality results at the wells. And we do a computation of ambient water quality for each management zone. It involves creating groundwater elevation contours, nitrate and TDS contour maps, and eventually these calculations. And the last thing we do, which is pretty helpful, is we develop these interpretive tools that we try to figure out what are some regional trends? Why are certain things happening, and what can we do to, you know, reverse some of those trends? So we'll talk a little bit about that in the next couple slides. So the next slide. So this is a map of the watershed, and it shows the location of the wells that we use in this recomputation for wells with TDS data. There's over 3,900 wells in the basin, in the watershed, that we use to do this comprehensive calculation. And the next slide. So this slide shows the distribution of wells with nitrate data, and there's about 4,200 wells with nitrate data in our watershed that are used to do this calculation. So as you can imagine, in each one of these, we try to get a 20-year time period of data. There's a lot of information that goes into these calculations. Next slide. So we're going to do a teeny bit of math. I won't get into it too much, but just wanted to explain the process. So each one of these basins is broken up into these grid cells, and they're 400-meter grid cells. What we try to do is we calculate the volume of water in each one of those grid cells, and you add up a grid cell for all of the cells in the management zone. Then you get the total volume of water in each management zone, and we use that number to calculate the volume weighted ambient water quality, which is the next slide. So here, what we do is we calculate from those point statistics, we contour, we interpolate between, and in the middle of each one of those 400-meter grid cells, we pull off the nitrate and TDS concentrations, and then we sum them all up and divide by the total volume, which we calculated in that previous slide, and we get this volume-weighted estimate of ambient water quality for the individual management zones. And I'll show you just a quick example of what I'm talking about in a map form. I think it'll make a little more sense. Next slide. Okay, so as I mentioned, we have those 400-meter grid cells, but this is the centroid of those grid cells. And for this example, I'm showing a nitrate concentration map. And so what we do is we pull off that nitrate value from each one of those grid cells and plug it into a spreadsheet model that does those calculations that I showed in the previous two slides. And we do that for every management zone, all 37 management zones. Next slide, please. And so this shows the results of the 2018 ambient water quality for TDS. Not a lot has changed over between the two time periods, the 20-year time period we did this time and the 20-year time period we did last time, ending in 2015. This one ended in 2018. 14 ambient water quality management zones for TDS improved, and as much as 40 milligrams per liter, it improved in the Irvine groundwater management zone, and it had also improved significantly in the Paris South groundwater management zone. And 12 of them remained the same, and 4 decreased slightly, only by 10 milligrams per liter. And really, the changes are mostly due to new monitoring points that are introduced into the calculation. Next slide. So this slide shows the results of all those calculations I was talking about. This shows the concentration of TDS by grid cell for every management zone. And just some things to point out is you can see there's a really high TDS in the Eastern Municipal Water District area in that Paris South subbasin. And in there, Eastern, they operate a desalter facility and to extract salt that goes through the Inland Empire brine line out to the ocean in Orange County. And they're actually working to expand their desalting facilities. and it really improves the groundwater quality over time in those basins. You might also note that the very high TDS is also located along the coast of California or coast of Orange County. And really that's due to seawater intrusion. And there's Orange County Water District monitors that, and they actually have seawater barrier wells to prevent the migration of seawater intrusion, but they have wells that monitor that. And so those results are part of this ambient water quality recomputation. Next slide. So we do the same thing for nitrate as we did for TDS. In this case, 12 of the management zones improved, and that improvement ranged from 0.1 milligrams per liter to 0.9 milligrams per liter of improvement. 8 of them remained the same, and 10 slightly decreased to 0.1 to 0.4 milligrams per liter. And none of the basins moved from compliance to non-compliance with the ambient water quality objectives, which is one of the key findings of these recomputations. And the next slide, please. And so this map is kind of analogous to the previous one I showed, where the previous one was TDS. This one is nitrate. And one thing to note here is you can see the southern portion of the Chino groundwater management zone. It looks like really high nitrates. And that's explained due to the historical dairies in ag that has was taking place in that area. And that's being addressed with a large desalter system called the Chino Desalter Authority. And they're currently removing salts and nitrates in that area and also, discharging to that Inland Empire brine line and cleaning up and improving the water quality of that management zone. So I know that's a lot of information, and on a watershed wide scale, there's a lot of information that goes into that, and so to help the stakeholders kind of understand exactly what's going on with each management zone, next slide please. We create these interpretive tools for each one of the groundwater management zones, and these interpretive tools are these atlas style maps that dig into each management zone and identify the changes from the 2015 to 2018 versions for both nitrate and TDS. And they track the water quality changes over time from all six recomputations that we've done. Next slide. And this year, new version that we did, technology has continued to improve, and we developed these interactive interpretive tools where we could upload some of this information to ArcGIS Online, and the stakeholders were able to interact with the data, kind of like a Google Maps. They can click on these trend maps and see over time how water levels or water quality increasing, decreasing. What are the trends? What are things that are sticking out, and what should we analyze in a little bit more detail? So it was really valuable this time, and these maps, there are these items here, they're hyperlinks. So if you would like to click on those, you could explore and spend hours looking at the water quality trends throughout the watershed. And then the next slide. So just the wrap it up. So the ambient water quality recomputation, really, it's a powerful tool that assists the stakeholders in managing the water resources throughout the Santa Ana watershed. As I mentioned, it's really a cool thing that the regional board is involved in this process and has been from the beginning. And we can use these tools to help identify these TDS and nitrate trends. The assessment of assimilative capacity, it's critical in permitting projects such as groundwater replenishment reuse projects. It assists these stakeholders in identifying these areas of potential concern that kind of pop up when you do this type of work on a watershed-wide scale. and it supports the Santa Ana River wasteland allocation and discharge permits. It encourages this collaboration effort with stakeholders and the regional board. You know, something that Tess talked about in the introduction, this is kind of a unique process to the Santa Ana River watershed. And a lot of people are looking to this as kind of a leading edge. This is cutting edge. This is the way good management, groundwater management is supposed to happen. People are starting to copy this. And finally, there's a scoping committee being formed at the Basin Monitoring Program Task Force to evaluate this, the ambient water quality in the future, and make sure that it complies with the updated recycled water policy. And so we're always continuing to evolve in this watershed and really be progressive and staying on top of the regulations that are coming from the State Water Resource Control Board. And, you know, we're kind of the envy of other regional boards in the state as it relates to this regional cooperation in salt and nutrient management. Well, that's my presentation. I know it's a little quick. There's a lot of information. I'd be happy to answer questions, but it's really an important effort that this watershed does, and I'm happy to, you know, present the information. Thank you very much.
Before we file this item, do the board members have any questions? Hearing no questions from the board, I think it was a thorough presentation. It provided good information. This was an item that had been postponed from our October 16th meeting, which was a very full meeting. And there's no action needed today. This is information that we will retain and use for future reference. Ms. Yes. Smythe, is there anything else?
Yes, let me just mention that we would be bringing this back to the board sometime in early 2021, just to ask you to formally approve the numbers that were generated out of this process, this evaluation, so that we can go on and start using those new ambient numbers in any permits that we issue across the region. So look for that in a few months.
Thank you. That brings us to item number 15, the Upper Temescal Valley Groundwater Management Zone Basin Plan Amendment. Cindy Lee will be making the presentation on this. I know we do have two speakers on this, so after we have the presentation and any board questions, we will then allow those two speakers. Ms. Lee.
All right, good morning. I think I cannot start my video. The host has stopped it. But nonetheless.
Cindy, can you get closer to your microphone?
Yes.
I can really hear you.
Yes. Can you hear me now?
That's a little better. Need to speak up.
Okay. All right. Can you hear me better? Hope, is it better now?
It's a little bit better.
A little bit.
All right.
I'm trying to turn up my volume on my end. But.
All right. I will increase the volume. I'm using a speaker headset. So is it better now?
That's better.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Good morning. Thank you, Hope. Chair Wu, members of the board. My name is Cindy Lee. I'll be presenting item 15. This is a proposed basin plan amendment to incorporate the salt and nutrient management plan for the Upper Temescal Valley Groundwater Management Zone, Resolution R8-2020-0038. As Chair Rowe mentioned, this was an item that postponed from previous meeting. Next slide, please. Here, you saw this map before when Michael made the presentation.
Yes.
I want to draw your attention to the area that's circled with red. You will notice that there that area has some area that do not have the what are called objective. So we call this Upper Temescal Valley area. is located between Lake Elsinore and the city of Corona. So water in this area, surface water, flow from southeast to northwest to Prado Basin through Orange County to the Pacific Ocean. The reason we don't have a water quality objective for this area because we do not have sufficient data. Next slide, please. Also, Michael also mentioned about the 2004 Basin Plan Amendment. At that time, with that Basin Plan Amendment, we revised the TDS and the nitrate objective for most groundwater management zones where we have sufficient data. But we did not establish TDS and nitrate objective for groundwater basins because there were enough data. So this include Bedford, Lee Lake, and Warm Spring Valley GMZs. Next slide, please. Here is another map. It's more folks in this area. The yellow is the watershed boundary, the surface watershed boundary. That's mark how the surface water drain from the hillside to the valley and flow from southeast to northwest. And the colored polygon, three colored polygon, depicts the three groundwater management zones, Warm Spring Valley, Lee Lake, Bedford, that's underlying the surface water in this valley. As I said, in the three groundwater management zones, we do not have the water quality objective established back in 2004. Also showing in this map are some discharge point. You will notice there, this is a wastewater treatment plant discharge in this area. The two discharge point I want to particularly draw your attention to are the Elsinore Valley Regional WRF and the Eastern Combined RWRF. These are right outside Lake Elsinore. These two discharge are regulated by MPDES. This is something Sean mentioned. So this is a surface water discharge regulated by the federal discharge program. And I'll talk a little bit more next. Next slide, please. All right, so back in 2011, we discovered that the discharges from this Elsinore Valley and Eastern periodically exceeded their TDS limit of 700 and 650 milligram per liter respectively. And the regional board issued MMMP and required them to do a offset. As part of the offset program, we asked them to evaluate the impact of the recycled water discharges on the underlying groundwater basins, the 3-1 listing the slides, and to the Santa Ana River at Prado. So we want to also ask them to evaluate in the impact to the downstream receiving waters. Next slide, please. So the agencies hired a consultant and did a study. They demonstrate that the discharges exceeded their limit, did not cause a measurable increase in the TDS concentration in the Santa Ana River Reach 2. However, because there weren't sufficient groundwater data, so they couldn't evaluate the impact of their discharge to the three groundwater management zones, Bedford, Lee Lake, and Warm Spring GMZs. Next slide, please. So both agencies come back to us, said, look, we want to develop a salt and nutrient management plan for this three management zones, and then we want to combine them into one. And staff agree that it's probably a good idea because without sufficient data, we really cannot evaluate the specific impact. So we asked them to develop a salt nutrient management plan, stand for SNMP, some people call SNMP. So we asked them to analyze the historical, current, and even projected ambient water quality to define the objective and also to propose implementation plan so that make sure the groundwater quality are protected in the future as well. Next one, please. I want to talk about why do we agree to for them to combine the three management zones into one. Really, the three groundwater management zones are very small and narrow. They're drained by the same creek, the Temescal Creek. Sometimes people call Temescal Wash. It's in between Lake Elsinore and the city of Corona. They have the same source of recharge, and groundwater really recharges between the headwater and the parts. The surface water, groundwater come out at the surface water and then recharge the groundwater downstream. I'll have a map to illustrate this. So really the three ground and the management zones are hydrologically connected. It makes sense to combine them into one. Next slide, please. Here is a map that shows the three GMZs. You will see that it's really located between the Santa Ana Mountains and the hills to the east, to the northeast. It's a very narrow strip. The yellow area marked the water bearing zone. So you'll see at the certain areas, it's very, very narrow. So groundwater and the surface water are highly connected. And the box on the north, the top right of the chart, sorry, to the right of the chart, also shows this valley is very narrow and it's very shallow. So the average width of this valley floor is about 1,000 feet and the length is 30 miles. The bedrock, the aquifer thickness to the bedrock is about 100 feet below surface. And the total storage of this entire area is about 50,000 acre feet. Just to give you a comparison, if you compare it to the Chino Basin area, the storage in that area is about 5 million acre feet. So this is a really small groundwater basin. And also the turnover rate is 5 to 7 years, meaning that water recharged to the basin will be flushed out in 5 to 7 years. Another characteristic of this valley is the groundwater is not confined. So the water quality is highly variable. Next slide, please. So because we did not have data to do the water quality computation, use the methods that Michael presented to you, we have to do an alternative method, but also scientifically based. So first of all, we combine the three into one, and then we propose the time period to do this computation is 1954 to 1973. This is the same as the 2004 Basin Plan Amendment. Next one, please. So I'm going to list this on different steps. I don't have to go through this, but no, maybe I'll use an illustration. I'll use a background. This is hard to see. Anyway, so first you estimate the storage volume, and then you kind of, like this bowl, we know how much water this groundwater base can hold. And then we estimate how much goes in and what's the volume and what's the concentration. And we also estimate what goes out. And then we use a model, basically a constant stir react model. You mix it up and you estimate the volume weighted TDS and nitrate concentration for this groundwater management zone. And we do this for each year. Next slide, please. And once we've done that for each year, because remember, the water quality objective is set for 20-year time period. We are using statistical methods to be more conservative. So these are the methods we use, ambient water quality with mean plus T-standard error of the mean. And then with that, we set that to be the water quality standard or water quality objective. Next slide, please. So this is a chart that actually shows a result. I know it's a complicated. Just look at the bar on top, those the elements goes in. So in recharge, what's go into the basin, the volume and the concentration, the bars at the bottom, what goes out of the basin, the volume and the concentration. And the flat dots are the ambient water quality for each year. And that we select 1954 to 1973, the box to the top right, that's the formula we use to compute water quality objective. Next slide, please. So here is a table that shows the TDS and nitrate calculate ambient concentration and propose objective. You note that we run the TDS, the calculated value for TDS of 820. We run that to be 822. We round that to be 820 to be conservative. For the nitrate, as nitrogen calculated value is 7.9 milligram per liter, and we did not do any rounding for this value. Next slide, please. And next, it's an important concept that Michael mentioned this briefly. It's a asymmetric capacity, because that affects how we regulate the discharges. So asymmetric capacity is a difference between current ambient water quality and water quality standard. Again, I'm going to use my kitchenware to illustrate this. It may or may not show very well. I apologize, the lighting may not be very good. Let me close the. So in this measuring cup, I mark area called ambient water quality. So that's the current water quality. And the top of the cup is the water quality standard. So you'll see that the current ambient water quality is better than the water quality standard. So that means we have room to allow more to be added. However, this is the discretion of this board. And here, the other instances, if you see the water quality objective is less than the water quality standard, the top of this cup is water quality object. Sorry, it's current ambient, and the water quality objective is by this mark. So you will see that current water quality is worse than objective. So that means we don't have room to add anything to the basin. So if that's the case, the discharge effluent limit cannot exceed the water quality objective. Next slide, please. So to determine if the basin has asymmetric capacity or not, we have to calculate the current ambient water quality. So we use the same method, but we use a different time period between 1995 and 2004. The current ambient TDS and the nitrate concentration as nitrogen are calculated to be 750 and 4.7 milligram per liter respectively. Next slide, please. So this chart, we listed both what proposed water quality objective and a current ambient, and then the asymmetric capacity. You'll see that for this basin, we have asymmetric capacity for both TDS and nitrate as nitrogen. Next slide, please. The anti-degradation analysis is required when this GMZ has asymmetric capacity and the water quality of the discharge is worse than objective or than the current ambient. Next one. Let's look at the TDS. Here, this table, I have the two facilities, Elsinore Valley Regional and Eastern, and their permit numbers, the TDS limit, and the current ambient TDS. You will notice their TDS limit 700 and 650, both below the current ambient TDS. And also remember the proposed objective is 820. So the TDS effluent limits are below the current ambient and the water quality objective. So we're fine. We don't have to do the anti-degradation analysis. Next one, please. But I do want to show the model result. On this chart, the dashed line on top, that's the proposed water quality objective, 820. And the two dashed line at the bottom are 700, 650, are the effluent limit. Even though the discharge effluent limit are below the objective, you'll see the TDS value highly variable. The dotted line are the TDS value modeled for a single year. And the curve, the colored line, are for the 20-year running average. So as I said, this basin, because it's very shallow, is narrow, and is unconfined, the TDS is highly variable. So time some period, the ambient water quality will be worse than objective. But some years, the ambient water quality will be better than the water quality objective. But bottom line is because the discharge limit are below what are called objective and current ambient. So discharge for these two facilities are not expected to degrade water quality. Next slide, please. Now let's look at nitrate. For nitrate, it's a different story. The same table, the two discharges and the parameter numbers, and the limit. We use TIN, the total inorganic nitrogen limit. Compare that to the current ambient nitrate as N. So you'll see that the ethanol limit are above current ambient and also above the proposed objective 4.9. So anti-degradation is required. Next one, please. Next slide. So they must determine if the recycled water will result in degradation of water quality, and they have to quantify how much degradation will occur, and if the allocation of cemented capacity is required, and then they have to demonstrate to the board why should the board allocate some cemented capacity to them. Next slide, please. So the same model was done and to estimate how much cemented capacity will be used. And the results show that the maximum 10-year average nitrate concentration is 5.6. So that's worse than the current ambient. And so they will use some of the cemented capacity. And then both agency has a request to use some cemented capacity. Next slide, please. Here, a similar chart, the dashed line on top. This is a proposed objective. I apologize, I think I said it wrong. The proposed objective is 7.9, not 4.9, 7.9. And the modeled results are below. So even though there will be some degradation to water quality for nitrate and nitrogen, the ambient water quality will be below the objective, meaning the beneficial uses of the groundwater basin will be protected. Next slide, please. So the justification for the board to allocate some of the cemented capacity is because the discharges will not result in the ambient water quality concentration to exceed the objective. Therefore, it will not result in an impairment of the beneficial uses of the basin. As a matter of fact, only 3% of cemented capacity will be used by the discharges from this two wastewater treatment plant. Next slide, please. Because we're proposing to establish water quality objective, the California Water Code Section 13241, requires that we consider all these factors. This table just lists what these factors are and a brief analysis. The staff report has a detailed analysis, so I won't repeat them here. I include this just for the record. Next slide, please. And the proposed basin plan amendment also has an element for implementation plan. There are 7 management actions proposed to make sure the groundwater quality being monitored, reported, and also the beneficial user protected. So again, the details of the implementation plan are described in section 7 of the staff report. Next slide, please. The basin plan amendment also is subject to CEQA. So in your package, there's a document called Substitute Environmental Document that has the analysis environmental checklist. And also the conclusion of this document is that no potential adverse impact will be caused with the adoption of the basin plan amendment. Next slide. The basin plan amendment also is subject to scientific peer review. The state board is coordinating and selecting peer reviewers based on the project. State Board staff selected 4 independent peer reviewers, and we, Regional Board staff, provided a technical report, including the groundwater modeling staff report, SED, and the technical document and assumptions related to this basin plan amendment. And we have received comments from reviewers and addressed their comments as well. In your package, there's a document called Response to Comments. Right. Overall, the reviewer agreed that the methods used to do this basin plan amendment were appropriate and scientifically sound. Next slide, please. So staff recommends that this board adopt resolution R8-2020-0038 for the following element. Yeah, we're going to revise table 3-1 and 4-1 of the basin plan to remove Bedford, Lee Lake, Warm Springs Valley GMZs and replace them with the Upper Temescal Valley GMZ. And that we transfer the beneficial uses from these three GMZs to the new GMZ. And then establish the TDS and a nitrate as nitrate objective 820 and 7.9 for the Upper Temescal Valley GMZ. And then also we propose to incorporate the implementation plan into the chapter 5 of the basin plan. And next, the board had to certify the substitute environmental document. Next slide, please. Next step, the staff, regional board staff, will submit the package to the state board for approval. And the regional board staff will also prepare the admin record for the Office of Administrative Law. And then the staff will have to file appropriate fees with the California Department of Fish and Wildlife according to CEQA. That concludes my presentation, and I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Ms. Lee, for a very, very thorough presentation.
Thank you.
Before we have two people who would like to address the board. Do the board members have any questions for Ms. Lee?
I don't have a question, but I do want to commend her on the use of props. That was very helpful for me, so yes. Thank you.
I did that for you last time. I'm trying to explain the asymmetric capacity to you, and I thought I did really well. And he said, come again.
Yes, so thank you.
Are there any other questions for Ms. Lee?
Yeah, I have a couple, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Ms. Lee, thank you. I always find this stuff scary, and it always reminds me why I dropped out of engineering in college. But there are a couple of things you said that I was curious about. One, you said there was a 5 to 7 year turnover in this basin, and that's very rapid. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And what's the reason for the turnover? Is it the fact that the basin isn't confined?
The basin is so small. The area, you know, it's the storage is 50,000 acre feet, right? Compared to that to Chino Basin, which is like 5 million.
Yes.
So it's also very shallow. It's narrow. So water doesn't stay. And because it's also in a narrow valley, surface water and groundwater are so interconnected, you can't hold too much water, so it keeps on flushing out.
Okay.
It's okay. Go ahead.
I understand. Thank you. That's fine. So when you calculated the current water quality there, the ambient water quality, you did it over a 20-year period. You said, is that right?
Correct. Yes.
And so why do you use a 20-year period to calculate the current ambient water quality?
So that we can compare, because the objective is set for 1954 to 1973, really to be consistent with the rest of the basins. You know, Michael's presentation talked about for the most basins, that is probably right, because groundwater quality does not change too much over time. And so we use 20-year running average to ease out this hydraulic cycle. And so you have a objective setting period, and then you have current ambient so that you can compare how the water quality is changing over time in this groundwater basin.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can understand using the long time period to set the objective, certainly, because you're trying to figure out on the objective, you know, what was the status of the water quality to begin with. I guess, and I can think I can understand your point about, you know, you wouldn't want to just take 1 year to look at the current ambient water quality, because that year might be suspect for some reason. But is taking a 20-year period sort of the norm for doing this? It seems like a long period for me to figure out what the ambient water quality is.
Right. This is a norm for this region. You know, we've been doing this for the rest of the basin. Just, I guess we want to be consistent. It may or may not be appropriate if you think, because this basin, yes, the turnover rate is shorter and the water quality is highly variable. The reason we do 20 years is to be consistent with the rest of the basin.
Rest of the basin, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Let me ask you one last question that I'm not sure it's for you or maybe it's for Hope. I don't understand the anti-degradation policy. I think I understand, you know, generally what we do, right? We set a water quality objective, and then we determine what the current ambient water quality is and try to figure out what impact a discharge will have and whether it will violate the objective. I think that's what the normal permit process is. But I don't understand the anti-degradation policy, because it seems to me that anti-degradation is supposed to make sure that the current ambient water quality doesn't get degraded. And it's that interplay I don't get.
Hope, do you want me trying to answer, or you want?
Oh, why don't you go first and then I can jump in if needed.
Right. And let me just use this like cup to help me. Sorry, this is the light in my room is by the window, so it's very too bright.
Do I hold my coffee cup up too? Is that
this is a measuring cup? Oh, it's okay. Really, my gosh. Okay, measuring cup. Okay, so the marker is called ambient water quality, meaning that's what the current water quality is like. You should imagine the top of the cup is objective, so meaning that your current water quality is better than the water quality objective. So this board would have this, meaning just from this basin, would have room to add more to it. But you don't want just allow anyone to add to it. You say, okay, so how much degradation will this discharge will cause? And then the assumed capacity is a difference between the current ambient and the water quality objective. And how much is you gonna use? Because we may want to reserve this for other future dischargers too. So maybe you want to just allocate a little bit to it. So that's what anti-degradation analysis is. It's really quantification, how much degradation will cost, how much assumed capacity the discharge will use. And then in terms of policy, is this to the benefit of the state of the people of the state? That's a decision that the board will make.
And I simply don't understand what anti-degradation means. Hope, do you want to add anything to that?
Sure. So what this anti-deg policy that the state board adopted in 1968, it really sets a benchmark against which future water quality is measured against. So what it says is that the quality that what happened in 1968 for a groundwater basin with regard to TDS or nitrate, that's the quality that we want to maintain. And so going forward in history, everything that's measured, the water quality in these groundwater management zones will be always compared to that quality in 1968. And the anti-degradation policy says that we should not be allowing quality to degrade, made worse than it was in 1968, unless there's some reason to do so. And so that's why it's really important for us to continue to collect the ambient water quality information for all of our groundwater basins to ensure that we're not allowing degradation to occur unnecessarily. You know, in some cases, there is reasons to do so. But that's kind of the benchmark against that we use to measure water quality going forward.
So, I should read the policy to understand it, and I'll drop this. But so it's not anti-degradation doesn't say don't degrade the current ambient water quality. It says don't degrade it to a level that's below what we had in 1968.
That's correct.
Right.
Unless there's a reason to do so.
Okay.
Right, and is that level the 820 figure that we've been talking about?
That's the proposed objective, right, Cindy?
Yes. That's correct. Yes.
I think so.
Well, I think, Lana, maybe you're asking, maybe I don't mean to interrupt you, but,
no,
but
go ahead.
What is the 1968 figure then that we're using for anti-degradation? I think that's what she's interested in, I'm interested in.
Yeah. So the problem was that we did not have a 1968 figure for these particular groundwater basins. There was not any data for us to that would have allowed us to calculate that water quality objective based on 1968 data.
Right.
So we did the modeling to simulate what those conditions would have been like back in 1968. Mm. So it's a different approach to developing that historic water quality data or information.
So what you're saying then is the number you're using for the anti-degradation objective is the same number you used for the traditional water quality that we use to set the objective. They're the same thing.
Same time period, yes. From 1954 to 1973, we used the alternative method.
The same number? What, you know, yes. I know what the 820 yes. means, I think. Yes. What's yes. the anti-degradation number?
That's an 820, correct, yes.
Yeah.
They're both the same number.
Yes.
It's just done with a different method of computation.
Okay. Thank you. I'm sorry to...
thanks, Dan, for clarifying. And then historically, like, because we didn't have the number before, what did we do before? We just didn't have one for this area?
That's correct.
Right. Okay. If you remember for Michael's presentation, you know, that's areas always NA, not available for... several cycles we've been doing this, and this is opportunity we believe is worthwhile for the agency to do this as an offset option.
Okay. Thanks.
Are there any other questions? We do have two speaker card. Yes.
I think, yeah.
Yes, Ms. Yes, Clark. Mr.
Chair, I do have a question, thank you. Just as a new member, I'm just curious, maybe Hope can answer this. You mentioned that we wouldn't go past or below that particular number, but for a particular reason. Could you just help identify what those reasons might be or what they would look like for my own edification?
Do you want me to take that one?
Yeah, sure. I don't have the policy in front of me. So.
Yes. So if you're going to allow degradation, you have to do the analysis and you have to show that the degradation will be consistent with the maximum benefit to the people of the state. And that's, you will get economic factors and other factors that will benefit by the degradation and compare that. And if that exceeds, or if that justifies the degradation, then you could proceed with the action.
Okay, but that's a very, that would entail a lot of discussion and analysis from this board. It's not just a cut and dry, this reason or that reason. That would take a lot of analysis on our part.
Correct, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Are there any other questions? Okay, our first comment card is from Al Javier with the Eastern Municipal Water District. Is Mr. Javier on the call?
Yes, I am.
Welcome.
Thank you. So everyone can hear me, correct?
Yes.
Thank you. Good morning, Chairman William Rue and board members. Thank you for allowing me to speak in support of item 15, adoption of resolution R8-2020. 0-0038 for the basin plan amendment for the Upper Temescal Valley Groundwater Management Cell. Again, my name is Alfred Javier. I am the Director of Environmental and Regulatory Compliance for Eastern Municipal Water District. EMWD, as Cindy has mentioned, does discharge into the Upper Temescal Valley there. And this is one reason why we are participating in the development of this Upper Temescal Valley Salt and Nutrient Management Plant. Mind you, EMWD, this is outside of EMWD's district. But we are, again, because we do discharge, we are participating in that. Back in 2013, EMWD, in cooperation with Elsinore Valley Municipal Water District, contracted Wildermuth Environmental, now called West Yost, to develop the regulatory strategy for the Upper Temescal Valley. This included technology methodology to compute historical ambient TDS and nitrate concentration, including the anti-degradation objective, estimating the current ambient TDS and nitrate, and providing future projection, as well as support in monitoring and reporting. This salt and nutrient management plan was completed and submitted to the regional board on October 9th, 2017, and was later approved on November 7th, 2017, establishing the water quality objective. This was a long endeavor working with Elsinore Valley Municipal Water District. We appreciate their cooperative and collaborative effort in this project. Additionally, we'd like to thank Wildermuth or West Yost for their assistance and expertise. Again, EMWD supports the adoption of the Basin Plan Amendment and thanks to regional board staff, both present and past, Cindy Lee, Keith Pearson, and Ken Thyssen for the willingness and guidance to make the Salt and Nutrient Management Plan successful in support of the Basin Plan Amendment. I should end with the shout out to Jane Joy, who was instrumental in starting this Salt and Nutrient Management Plan. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Javier. Our next speaker is Parag Kalaria, also with Eastern Municipal Water District. Welcome, Mr. Kalaria.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair William Brew. My name is Parag Kalaria. I am with Elsinore Valley Municipal Water District.
Oh, I'm sorry. I had the wrong. I had Eastern. It's Elsinore Valley. Thank you.
Not a problem. I'm the Water Resources Manager here at the Elsinore Valley Municipal Water District. Thank you, Cindy, for a great presentation. And Al did a great job summarizing it as well. So I'm going to keep it very brief. Again, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak on this item today. On behalf of EVMWD, I want to start by thanking the staff at the regional board. Again, Cindy Lee, Jane Joy, Hope Smythe, Keith, Ken Thyssen, and Ann. This was truly a collaborative effort, which started, as you can see from the presentation from Cindy, we started this process almost over a decade ago. And we have been working on this plan with the Regional Water Quality Control Board and Eastern Municipal Water District for a very long time. It was important for the district to ensure that the study is scientifically sound and very defensible. And as you can see from the Cindy's presentation, it was demonstrated we had gone through a very extensive peer review process as we wanted to make sure we do the things very right. On behalf of Elsinore Valley Municipal Water District, we want to say we are very committed to implementing the management actions pursuant to the Salt and Nutrient Management Plan to protect the Upper Temescal Valley Groundwater Management Zone, which includes the three groundwater basin within the service area of Elsinore Valley Municipal Water District. Again, in summary, you know, we are committed to protect the groundwater basin and committed to implement the management actions, and we fully support the Basin Plan Amendment. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kalaria. Do the board members have any additional comments or questions? Any information for the good of the order from staff?
Nothing else from us.
Okay. With that, I would ask for, a motion for this item.
I move.
It's been moved by Director Peterson. Is there a second? Second by Director Murray. Ms. Aguilar, could you please do the roll call vote?
Board Member Letitia Clark.
Aye.
Board Member Joe Kerr.
Aye.
Board Member Chris Murray.
Aye.
Board Member Lana Peterson.
Aye.
Board Member Daniel Selmy.
Aye.
Board Member Dr. Tom Rivera.
I abstain.
Chair William Rue.
Aye. Therefore, the motion passes. That brings us to item number 16, which is the Human Right to Water Status Update, and Ms. Sturdivant will present.
Good morning. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
Good morning. This is Ann Sturdivant. I'm Chief of the Groundwater and Regulatory Division, and I'm also the Environmental Justice Liaison for Region 8, the Santa Ana Region. May I please have the slides? In the meantime, I hope everyone's well and healthy, and welcome to our new board member. It's nice to see all of you, even if it's on Zoom. I do look forward to the day when we're all together again.
I as well.
Thank you, Don. So today we'll be presenting the annual report on the human right to water pursuant to the resolution that you adopted last year, R8-2019-008. And co-presenting to me today with me is Celia Pazos of our Coastal Stormwater section and previously of our Cannabis Unit. Next slide, please. As an overview, today I'll present some background and remind you of the federal and state recognition of the human right to water, your adoption of a resolution last year, and the two-year work plan that went along with that resolution. Then I'll summarize staff's efforts during 2020, which included collaboration with the Division of Drinking Water, performance of an internal program assessment, and data compilation and mapping efforts. And we'll summarize at the end and conclude with next steps. Next slide, please. In 2010, the United Nations embraced the human right to water, which is that every human being has the right to safe, clean, affordable, and accessible water, adequate for human consumption, cooking, and sanitary purposes. California followed suit in 2012 code to embrace the right to water and the core value of all the water boards. The state board as well adopted resolution 2016-0010, adopting the human right to water as a core value. And last year, as mentioned, you, the board, adopted resolution 2019-0078, and that included a two-year work plan with specific tasks for staff to perform in support of the human right to water. Next slide, please. For further background and a reminder, the mission statement for the state and regional water boards is to preserve, enhance, and restore the quality of water resources and drinking water for the protection of the environment, public health, and all beneficial uses, and to ensure proper water resource allocation and efficient use for the benefit of present and future generations. This means that the mutual goal and focus of all the board programs is to protect water resources so they're available for everyone to use. Next slide. And a few definitions here that will end up as some acronyms as I'm speaking and presenting here. Disadvantaged communities, or DACs, are defined as the census tracts with median household incomes that are less than or equal to 80% of the statewide median household income. Tribal communities are defined by the California Native American Heritage Commission. So you will see the locations of some of those communities in some maps that are coming up. And environmental justice means the fair treatment of people of all races, cultures, and incomes with respect to the development, adoption, implementation, and enforcement of environmental laws, regulations, and policies. EJ communities are the most impacted by environmental harms and risk, and they're also known as overburdened communities. The EJ principles are an important part of CalEPA's goal to restore, protect, and improve the environment, and to ensure the health of people, the environment, and the economy. It's a lot of information on one slide. I'd like you to just keep in mind these definitions as we move through.
Right.
Next slide, please. So to get to the two-year work plan, we've just completed year one, and these are the things that we performed in 2020. We've been collaborating with the State Water Board's Division of Drinking Water, or DDW, to identify impaired water systems. And this actually began in 2019. We started working with staff from DDW to investigate ways that we could participate in promoting the human right to water, and especially in disadvantaged communities. This is appropriate because DDW regulates California's drinking water systems. And you heard a bit about that earlier from Mr. McGuire. The goal was to add projects that qualify for placement on the Regional Board's Supplemental Environmental Projects, or SEP, list. The SEP list prioritizes projects that could benefit disadvantaged communities, EJ communities, and the human right to water. And just today, you adopted by consent the new SEP list, and you'll see in a little while that some of those projects have been added to the SEP list. We also had to conduct an internal assessment of the equity of Regional Board programs, and create or obtain maps of regional board sites and programs with overlays of DACs, tribal communities, and EJ communities. Next slide, please. So I'll move into some of the details of our collaboration with DDW. Next slide, please. We met with DDW staff to identify impaired water systems in DACs and EJ communities throughout from the middle of 2019 on throughout 2020. Note that the Regional Board's Division of Drinking Water and the State Water Board as a whole has no jurisdiction over water quality or water systems that are within federal lands or tribal communities. So we focused on the DACs and EJ communities where the jurisdiction is. Another thing to note is that the DDW's Safe and Affordable Funding for Equity and Resilience, or SAFER, program, which came into effect through legislation in 2019, that was SB 200, this provides a set of tools, funding sources, and regulatory authorities that are designed to meet the goals of safe, accessible, and affordable drinking water for all Californians. Importantly, this required the DDW to perform a statewide assessment of water systems, produce updated maps, and identify at-risk public and domestic water systems. Next slide. So throughout this effort, DDW staff shared information about the impaired water systems that they were identifying through the SAFER program and potential improvement projects. This occurred during monthly meetings with our staff. And projects were evaluated for eligibility to be included on the Regional Board SEP list, prioritizing the DACs and environmental justice communities. As mentioned, three eligible projects were added to the SEP list, and you again adopted that SEP list today already. So in order to promote this further, Regional Board staff will continue to collaborate with DDW. We've already requested future consideration of SAFER funding for retrofitting an emergency response for impaired or vulnerable water systems in disadvantaged communities. Next slide, please. Now to our internal program assessment. Next slide, please. To perform the assessment, staff reviewed the program goals, objectives, and activities for all of our programs and considered possible correlations with the human right to water. Staff provided comments and suggestions, and a focus group is now reviewing the input to evaluate feasibility and legal authority. Stakeholder input will be solicited prior to any recommendations from staff. Next slide. The internal program assessment took place during May and June of this year. And some of the challenges and needs for this were to define and understand the human right to water, and for staff to evaluate the Regional Water Board's actual role in promoting the human right to water, and then to consider ways that their own program activities affect the human right to water. In so doing, they provided comments and suggestions about the programs. And the focus group that I mentioned has been performing an initial review of comments and suggestions. We've also downloaded and refined data sets for four of the Water Board programs. We've created maps to aid in the visualization of potential patterns and overlap of program activities as they relate to disadvantaged tribal and environmental justice communities and homeless encampments, which are a disadvantaged community. Additional maps are in progress and further assessment will continue. Next slide, please. So here was the first challenge I mentioned. What is the Water Board's role in promoting the human right to water? I listed the four factors here again. Water must be safe, clean, affordable, and accessible. And as an overarching agency, the State Water Board must consider the human right to water in establishing policies, regulations, grant criteria. And this is all called out in the Water Code now. The State Water Board also has authority to protect the quality of water resources throughout the state through its policies, regulations, and grant programs. Specifically, programs within the State Water Board, such as the Division of Water Rights, have jurisdiction over the use and management of some water resources. Division of Financial Assistance administers grants to address impaired water systems and clean up contaminated groundwater. And the State Board, DDW regulates drinking water systems, as mentioned, and the State Board can require polluters to provide replacement water for impacted drinking water sources. So all of these bullets relate to safe, clean, affordable, and accessible water. Next slide, please. And now to narrow it down to the regional board role, the regional boards also have broad authority to protect. We protect beneficial uses and water quality within the region to promote safe and clean water. We can require polluters to provide replacement water for residents with impacted water supply. We can issue permits that affect access to sanitation, but we do not have authority to allocate water resources. We must consider all four factors above, but we cannot require that water is affordable and accessible. We have to work with others to meet these goals. Next slide, please. And I'm going to share some of staff's observations during the internal program assessment. Next slide, please. In general, staff sees promotion of the human right to water as a natural outcome of most water board programs. And this is in accordance with the mission statement mentioned earlier. Further, protecting the quality of water resources so they're clean and safe is the first step toward achieving affordable and accessible water. Staff did not identify a need to substantially alter how programs are managed. Next slide. To go on, staff recognizes that other agencies and entities have authority or influence on accessibility and affordability of clean water. And I touched on this a moment ago. Some of those organizations and agencies are listed here. One that's a little different in bullet four is the ratepayers who make water available to secondary users. We have to consider these as well. They provide water to secondary users, and that includes visitors to public places and businesses. So we have to consider all of these items and agencies listed when we reach out and try to make sure that we're promoting the human right to water with others. Our region board programs interact with some of these entities in different ways. For example, through collaboration, we have joint regulatory oversight and enforcement with some county entities like environmental health. But in other cases, other county entities are actually regulated discharge under our permitting system. Next slide. Staff also recognized that we need to have a uniform understanding of our roles, responsibility, and authority in order to develop strategies to support the human right to water in each of our programs. This is important because all staff were looking at their own activities and their staff's activities and the programs that they're functioning in. So we try to have a uniform understanding by understanding the definition of the human right to water. Staff also recognize that there's a limited ability for us to evaluate impacts to the human right to water at the individual scale. But staff can work to assess water quality impacts and needs at a community scale. This is through collaboration with other agencies, as mentioned, and engaging with municipalities in efforts to address safe, clean, affordable, accessible water, especially for DACs and EJ communities, such as the homeless community. Next slide, please. One set of observations pertaining to permits is that we issue waste discharge requirements and NPDES permits, which regulate proposed or existing waste discharges. The permits contain discharge limits and monitoring requirements based on water quality standards and provisions, and some of which, such as Cindy was mentioning earlier. The discharge limits then protect the beneficial uses, such as drinking water and groundwater recharge. So through these permits, we preserve, restore, and sometimes we even enhance the quality of water bodies that are used as sources of drinking water. Next slide. another program to address here is the cleanup programs, which are underground storage tanks and the actual site cleanup program, which is mostly industrial facilities and old groundwater contamination sites. The water boards oversee cleanup of soil and groundwater at these sites, and local groundwater quality information is really important in this effort. However, it may not be readily available to water board staff. Water quality data from the private wells could help alert us to impacts in areas that haven't been looked at yet, and staff typically relies on the willingness of private well owners to provide such data. We have no authority over private wells, and so there are challenges involved with obtaining the data. Next slide, please. With regard to the basin plan, staff recognizes the need to evaluate how beneficial uses intersect with the human right to water. Some specific basin planning activities correlate more directly with the human right to water. Next slide. So as an example, and as a prelude to some information you'll see on the upcoming maps, I want to talk about the integrated report, which is a basin planning effort. The integrated report is an assessment of the quality of surface waters, determining if pollutants are present at concentrations that exceed water quality objectives. So if a beneficial use is impaired, the surface water is placed on the US EPA's 303D list. And that means it's impaired, defined as impaired, and total maximum daily load specifications, also known as TMDLs, are developed for that impaired water body. Staff believes that these programs, the integrated report and TMDL efforts, protect and enhance the quality of waters and preserve beneficial uses and are largely protective of the human right to water. Next slide. Overall, the internal program assessment could eventually result in changes to our permits and our basin planning activities. The focus group and legal counsel are currently reviewing staff's input to evaluate feasibility and legal authority. And remember, stakeholder input will be solicited prior to any staff recommendations in the future. Next slide, please. Oh, and I wanted to mention on the stakeholder involvement, we've already had meetings in 2018 and 2019 with the permitted entities under the municipal stormwater permit. And we will continue other such meetings with stakeholders, soliciting input and outreach to the community as needed. And the next section you'll see now is the maps, which is my favorite thing. Next slide, please. Today, the maps you will see will show the disadvantaged communities, the environmental justice communities, and the tribal communities in our region. You'll see the geographic distribution of some of the Water Board's program activities. You'll see the 303D listed or impaired water bodies in the region. You'll see the locations of some homeless encampments. You'll see the impaired drinking water systems and the locations of three projects that were added to the region's SEP list. Next slide, please. I wanted to mention some challenges in this effort because it's not just easy to put everything on maps, and Celia will share that with you as well. When mapping disadvantaged and environmental justice communities, there are different sources of data to define the disadvantaged or median household income information. We have the California Department of Water Resources publishing boundaries at different scales. We have census tracts, census blocks. There's also a layer in our own State Water Board GeoTracker database, which is using 2012 to 2016 income data at the moment and is currently going to be updated. And then the median income and environmental data are synthesized into another tool, Cal EPA's Cal Enviro Screen Mapping Tool. So the maps for this assessment, we believe, should rely on accurate and consistent base layers. Next slide, please. So for that reason, we selected the Cal Enviro Screen as our base layer method. And it's a science-based mapping tool that was developed by the Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment, or OEHA, part of Cal EPA. It comprehensively identifies not only the disadvantaged communities, but EJ communities as well. Communities that are suffering from cumulative impacts of multiple pollutants and communities where people are especially vulnerable to pollution's effects, with conditions like asthma or other respiratory ailments. And it's a publicly available tool. I put the link here on my slide. Next slide, please. I want to provide acknowledgments. I mentioned that the Division of Drinking Water provided data files. They also provided digital maps and the locations of the impaired water systems. Our own staff created additional data layers showing sites related to water board program activities. And Celia did a very excellent job in that area, and you'll hear from her in just a moment. The homeless encampment location information on the maps was provided by the Santa Ana Watershed Project Authority, or SAPA, also the Riverside County Flood Control District. And please bear in mind that the homeless encampment populations and locations shift. They move around, they change in size and population, individual people. And the map you'll see shows only a portion of the homeless population. It's only a part of the picture. It doesn't show necessarily homeless encampments that are not near waterways. So bear in mind, there are other homeless encampments that won't be seen on the map because there's no data available to us for those, and because they move. Next slide, please. And with one more bullet here on the homeless population, I provided the numbers here. Please keep in mind that Riverside County, San Bernardino County, and Orange County areas all fall within the Santa Ana Regional Board, but not the full area of any of these three counties. So the numbers do not represent homeless numbers in our region, but these are the available numbers from 2020 and 2019. And I think with that, we'll be giving it over to Celia. Next slide, please. There you go. Thank you.
Hi, good morning, everyone. Thank you, Anne. So as Anne mentioned earlier, one of the commitments in our year one work plan was to utilize existing data and maps to identify locations of tribal, disadvantaged, and environmental justice communities in Region 8, and then to use program information to better visualize potential impacts to the human right to water. So the map on the screen and the ones that follow have Region 8, the watershed outlined in orange. Cal Enviro's green disadvantaged communities are shaded yellow. Our tribal lands in the region are shaded purple, and the 303 delisted or impaired water bodies are bolded blue. The map on screen is displaying a data set that includes the locations of homeless encampments in Region 8. They're shown as red circles. The data set was provided to us by SAPA and the Riverside County Flood Control District, which is why we see the concentration of sites along the Santa Ana River, where the agency focused its county efforts. The homeless community is a disadvantaged community, and we plan to use this and similar data to assess our programs at Region 8. And we have an example on the next slide. Next slide, please. So this is the exact same map you saw earlier on the previous slide, with the red circle showing the locations of homeless encampments, but it also includes the distribution of our active industrial stormwater sites shown in green. So this is just one of the ways that we are addressing possible impacts to homeless encampments and other disadvantaged communities. We are using available data to check for any program overlap with these disadvantaged communities. Next slide, please. So this map was presented to the regional board last year and was provided to us by the Division of Drinking Water. So as Anne mentioned earlier, Region 8 staff have been coordinating with DDW to identify impaired water systems in the region. So the map shown includes community water systems in the state, shown as gray circles, and it also includes water systems that have had a violation, which is an exceedance of some MCL. They're shown as red stars. Next slide, please. So we took that information from the large map and brought it into the regional map. So we see that the red stars, or the systems with violations on the previous slide, are shown here as red circles. We can also see that many of them fall within disadvantaged communities. And as a result of our collaboration with DDW, three impaired water systems were added to the SEP list approved by you all this morning, and they're shown on the map as green circles. Next slide, please. So the following maps were created based on staff suggestions and talked a little bit about it earlier. So this one is similar to the previous maps, where our DACs are shaded yellow, the tribal lands are shaded purple, and 303D listed water bodies are bolded blue. We also, on this map, labeled Big Bear Lake, Lake Elsinore, and Canyon Lake for some perspective. Next slide, please. So this is the same as the previous map, but we added TMDL program information. In this case, we identified 303D impaired water bodies and their TMDL status. The red highlighted waterways are those that have a TMDL under implementation, and the light blue sections, mostly up near Big Bear Lake, are those that have a TMDL under development. Next slide, please. This is the map for our site cleanup section. We have our site cleanup section sites within disadvantaged communities plotted by their status. You can see where we have open cases under remediation shown as green squares, closed cases shown as red squares, and sites under assessment shown as blue circles. With this data, we can begin to answer questions posed by staff, such as what are the number of sites located within disadvantaged communities? Which sites within disadvantaged communities enter remediation each year? And which cleanup sites, if any, receive funding within disadvantaged communities? Those are parts of the future assessment to be done. Next slide, please. So the final two maps were generated for the cannabis program's human right to water assessment. So for the cannabis program, the work plan identifies two potential program impacts to the human right to water. The first one is the potential exploitation of labor at unpermitted cultivation sites where workers may be denied reasonable access to safe and clean water. Boards enforcement sites on this map are shown as green squares, and enforcement sites with evidence of labor exploitation are shown in red. These sites are concentrated in Riverside County, as you can see the cluster of symbols there, where outdoor cultivation is possible. These are areas like Paris, Nuevo, and Homeland. So staff assessed the 48 enforcement sites for evidence of human trafficking or labor exploitation, where workers may be denied access to safe and clean water. Evidence of exploitation included makeshift living outdoor areas, cooking areas, and restrooms with no running or hot water. It also included outdoor tents containing bedding and personal belongings. Staff identified 13 enforcement sites with evidence of labor exploitation in Region 8. This map also shows the distribution of enrolled facilities as blue circles. Staff has concluded that the cannabis program issues permits equitably to facilities that meet requirements in the general order, and the number and distribution of permitted sites is reflective of local restrictions and not limits on water board staff or resources. Next slide, please. The second potential impact to the human right to water identified in the work plan for the cannabis program is the potential for adverse impacts to surface water or groundwater quality from unpermitted grows in disadvantaged communities, particularly those that rely on private wells for water. So this map shows the DACs shaded in yellow and includes Region 8 groundwater management zones shaded in green. The 48 unpermitted sites are shown as red circles if they discharge tailwater to the ground, and as blue circles if they discharge their tailwater to a water body. Sites that used groundwater via private wells are highlighted with white circles. Staff found that 15 inspected sites use groundwater as the site supply, and 12 of them discharge tailwater to open land. So there are many other issues to consider with regard to the human right to water, and this is just an example of our preliminary work, and we do have a series of next steps and future work that Anne will go over now. Next slide, please.
Thank you, Celia. Great maps. So I'll just give you a few next steps that we have that will take place in the next year and ongoing after that. I can't promise everything will get done in 1 year, especially with some of the COVID issues we've had without being able to initiate a lot of public outreach in a very efficient way. But I will go through these steps, and these tasks will be performed. They're in the work plan. And we're going to continue to evaluate the results from the assessment, first of all. Then create additional maps, as Celia mentioned, and that will aid in visualizing potential patterns and relationships between staff activities and impacts to the human right to water. We'll create or acquire maps of available private well data. I've already mentioned some challenges that come with that, but we'll be pursuing that because it very much helps us in understanding the water quality and issues in the groundwater. We will conduct spatial analysis of the map data, which is a technique using geographic information system tools, or GIS as it's called. We'll also continue to coordinate with DDW staff regarding impaired water systems, conduct outreach, as mentioned, to solicit input from communities, permittees, and other stakeholders. We will review and respond to those comments we receive and prepare recommendations as appropriate and bring those to the board at some future time. And meanwhile, we will present a mid-year 2021 update to you next year. Next slide, please. I think that summarizes everything. If you have questions for myself or for Celia, please ask, and we're available at the emails listed below. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Sturdivant, for a very, very good report. And I really commend Ms. Pazos on the maps. They were informative. Are there any questions from our board on the presentation? Okay.
Thank you.
Yes. Go ahead. Who had a quick? Go ahead. It was very thorough. Well done. Thank you for the report.
Thank you, and Merry Christmas to all of you.
Same to you, Ms. Sturdivant. That brings us to item number 17, Underground Storage Tanks Corrective Action Plan. That is a receive and file. After that, item 18, Underground Storage Tank Site Closure Report, receive and file. Item number 19, our Executive Officer's Report, is a receive and file.
Mr. Chair?
Smythe, yes, go ahead.
If I could just add just kind of an FYI to the board. You've probably seen in the news a report regarding Orange County Water District's lawsuit for PFAS contamination
into
their groundwater system. I just want to inform the board that we do have a planned presentation in February of our activities related to PFAS. So that will be before you in a couple of months.
Oh, thank you very much. I know that's another item that is of big importance to the state board as well. And it's something that is just emerging in the last few years. So it'll be good to get that information.
Yes.
That brings us to item number 20, regional board member and executive officer communications. Do any of the members of the board wish to say anything?
I have one quick comment. So I know that we talked about the calendar board meeting dates. None of those dates conflict right now, but I think everyone knows that I work in healthcare, and so we're kind of entering the third phase. And so I think adding a meeting in February will be difficult for me, kind of just anticipating that. So just an FYI, just wanted to kind of get that out there. So it's all hands on deck right now.
No, thank you, Director Peterson. I know that's something that we are all very sensitive to right now. I know certain competing demands on my time as well.
Yes. I have a comment, Mr. President.
Yes.
The director's report, I was very gratified to hear that Beaumont has complied with all the agreements that they came with us in late last year and was able to get their plant going, sewer plant going, and also their salt water pipe to San Bernardino. And I was delighted that there were many improvements that they agreed to have for us if we give them some type of extension, and they did comply with that extension.
Yes, they did. They really stepped up on that.
To add to that, will the city of Beaumont come back to the board and circle back like with a final presentation on that particular project
It's up to the board. We can certainly ask them to come back and give us an overall summary of their activities. One of the things I do believe we have a renewal of their permit coming up sometime, so maybe that might be an appropriate time for them to speak to, what their upgrades have consisted of.
Okay, that sounds good.
Yeah, I'm fine with that, but I agree with Tom. It wasn't looking good for them at all to begin with on this, and they really did what seems to me a remarkable job of getting that project up, going, and finished.
Yes.
So at least informally, I hope I would like you to express our appreciation to them for that, because they really did a great job as far as I can see.
They did. This is a multi-year ongoing situation. And they really, you're right. They stepped up. They did what needed to be done. And they're to be commended for it.
Yes.
Not always easy.
I will write them a letter on behalf of the board.
Great.
Are there any other comments from the board?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
Just want to thank everyone again for the warm welcome. I thought this was a great meeting. Just this meeting alone, I learned a lot. I was particularly interested in the human right to water status update. I thought that was particularly interesting. Also, in a previous life, I used to work for the New Orleans Metropolitan Association of Realtors as a GAD. So I think you and I may have interacted.
Okay, yes.
So it's nice to be reconnected.
We're supposed to have our NAR conference in New Orleans this year, but it was held virtually.
Oh.
And not quite as fun, but still good information. And when we are back able to really meet in person, I look forward to meeting with some of our newer board members on just getting to know you.
Yes, thank you.
How was the virtual food from New Orleans?
So help your diet.
I would like to, this has been a challenging year for all of us, not just in our board life, but in our professional and personal lives. This is also a time of celebration. We celebrate Christmas and Hanukkah and Kwanzaa and so many other traditions. And there's still a lot to celebrate. Our traditions may change a little, but they're still there. And underlying all of the celebrations in this season are two things, joy and hope. And we need that. I'd like to close, if I may, with something that is a favorite of mine. It was written 507 years ago on Christmas Eve 1513 by Fra Giovanni to his friend Contessa Alagia Aldobrandeschi. And I think it sums up every tradition, every culture, all of our celebrations. I'll have to read it because the printed copy I left at home. There is nothing I can give you which you have not, but there is much, very much, that while I cannot give it, you can take. No heaven can come to us unless our hearts find rest in today. Take heaven. No peace lies in the future which is not hidden in this present little instant. Take peace. The gloom of the world is but a shadow. Behind it, yet within our reach, is joy. There is radiance and glory in the darkness, could we but see, and to see, we have only to look. I beseech you to look. Life is so generous a giver, but we, judging its gifts by the covering, cast them away as ugly or heavy or hard. Remove the covering and you will find beneath it a living splendor woven of love by wisdom with power. Welcome it, grasp it, and touch the angel's hand that is bringing it to you. Everything we call a trial, a sorrow, or a duty, believe me, the angel's hand is there. The gift is there and the wonder of an overwhelming presence. Your joys too. Be not content with them as joys. They too conceal diviner gifts. Life is so full of meaning and purpose, so full of beauty beneath its covering, that you will find earth but cloaks your heaven. Courage then to claim it. That is all. But courage you have. And the knowledge that we are all pilgrims together, wending through an unknown country, home. Peace to everybody. Namaste.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you.
Have a good Christmas.
Thank you, Bill. Appreciate that.
So I think we are adjourned until February's board meeting.
Oh, wow.
Great. Thank you, everyone.
See you guys
Thank
then. You.
Have a good holiday season.
Thank you.
Good holidays.
Merry Christmas.